Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, December 10th, 2024, we're delighted to host a discussion on AI policy in President Trump's second term. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time and getting to the discussion, we will keep our introductions today extremely brief, not much more than name and title, which is certainly more brief than our distinguished guests' careers deserve. So if you'd like to know more, I would highly recommend you access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Professor Kevin Frazier, who currently serves as an assistant professor of law at St. Thomas University's Benjamin L. Crump College of Law, who teaches at Ad Law, Con Law, and Civil Procedure. And I will leave it to him to introduce our panel. A last note, and then I'll get off your screens. If you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen. It will be accessible when you get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining today. Professor Frazier, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Kayla, and thank you very much to the Federalist Society for the opportunity to moderate this important conversation. Big thanks also to our esteemed panelists for joining us today. So as Kayla suggested, these bios will be way too brief for all the important work these folks are up to, but I'm going to keep them brief nonetheless. So first up, we have Adam Thier, the resident senior fellow in the technology and innovation team at R Street. Thanks for joining, Adam.
Thanks.
Pleasure. Satya Thalam, the Senior VP at Americans for Responsible Innovation. Welcome, Satya.
Hey, guys.
And we have Neil Chilson, the Head of AI Policy at the Abundance Institute. Thanks for joining, Neil.
Glad to be here.
Okay, well, with that, let's start with laying the foundation. There's a narrative out there that AI policy kind of started with the Biden administration, and that in many ways neglects important work that was done under the first Trump administration, thinking about how to unleash the promises of AI innovation across the U.S. So, Satya, can you give us a sense when we're trying to get a picture of what AI policy may look like in the second Trump administration, what we should perhaps learn from the first Trump administration?
Yeah, and thanks, Kevin. Thanks, FedSoc, for convening this panel, putting this all together. I think I have the easiest job because I don't have to predict the future, so I can say this and then get out of the way, just like leave it to y'all, and I can take credit for everything that you guys say. So my context in this is having worked in the first Trump White House and related to the Trump EO on AI and later implementation specifically. So I think to some degree, most folks who are familiar with the Trump EO or the considerations of AI in the first Trump term are generally familiar with, in reductive terms, kind of in contrast to the Biden administration, where they, you know, emphasis on non-regulatory approaches. You know, the Trump EO and later implementation and guidance, which I'll mention in a second, were done in a larger metastructure, a larger policy metastructure of emphasis on either deregulation or very acute consideration of regulatory costs, minimizing costs. There was a larger regulatory budget that a lot of these things had to exist in, not just AI, but in other areas as well. So I think that's pretty, well known. I think it's useful if we're going to summarize it. The EO itself references AI leadership, maintaining American AI leadership. It starts with that as the conclusion and then works backwards to, at least in the view of the Trump administration, what are the inputs? What are the premises that are necessary to maintain and advance American leadership in AI that are debatable? People could say those are not the correct ones, but those are. But there are some things around collaboration between the private and public sector. Again, consideration of non-regulatory approaches to policy. But I think what's most important actually is the, and the thing that I was most directly involved with was OMB guidance to agencies. So in the EO, it directs the OMB director to issue to agencies guidance on how to implement consideration. And while there is continued repetition the sort of incantation of consideration of non-regulatory approaches, I think there are some things that people would find surprising. Languages around how regulations that address specific risks can, quote, provide an enabling environment for the private sector. There's consistent reference to public trust in AI. There's a whole section on public trust in AI, that applications could pose risks to privacy, individual rights, choice, public health, national security. That public trust and validation is a necessary condition for continued adoption in the sector, promotion of reliability, robustness, trust. There's a mention of real world bias, which I think most people would be surprised to hear. Cybersecurity and adversarial use and risk, and also a specific section on international regulatory cooperation. So obviously, all that said, this was issued, all this work was done in 2019, 2020. That was a completely different world in terms of what we understand of AI, the capabilities. If they're writing it now, which I'm sure they are, it's done in a totally different environment. But I guess I want to emphasize there are actually, and there's also multiple references to NIST to help develop technical standards and voluntary standards and guidance. So I think actually one of the stories is that there's actually a lot of themes that were continued, that were the foundation was laid in the first Trump administration and continuing the Biden administration. Of course, with Biden taking on more language around bias and fairness and things that I'm sure the incoming administration is going to say, we want to excise all that. But there are a lot of themes that were continued. I think that's kind of an underreported story.
Satya, we didn't make you predict the future. One thing I can go ahead and claim that we know that the AI czar will not be Kamala Harris. So we've crossed that off. Instead, we have a new AI czar. And I guess to be formal, we're going to have a czar for AI and crypto. So broad portfolio, easy questions to handle. Adam, you've written about this AI czar and what we may be able to learn about David Sacks from his prior work, about whether we could see some continuity in the Trump administration's approach to AI that Satya laid out. What's your two cents on how this AI czar may shape the future of AI policy under the next administration?
Yeah, so recently President Trump nominated David Sacks as the AI and crypto czar, a dual role. It's an unprecedented kind of thing, but we're going to see him basically take a leadership role, I think, in this White House to try to coordinate the disparate parts of the government that are dealing with AI now. You know, AI has become such an all-encompassing public policy issue now. And as Satya rightly said, like the debate we were having when Trump was previous in office was far more sort of rudimentary, and we were operating at the level of sort of abstract principles more than anything else. They were very good principles, in my opinion. And frankly, and I've recommended that Mr. Sacks come into office and basically pick up where the original Trump team left off on this, because I think that the 2019 executive order, and especially that OMB guidance, had some really excellent principles in it. And it's very, very important that the White House take the lead in directing, sort of providing a vision to the agencies and making sure that they are on the same page. I mean, there's just so many different agencies. You know, at the high level, you have OSTP, obviously, Office of Science, Technology, Policy. You have NTIA and NIST within the Department of Commerce and other parts of commerce that deal with other issues, including things like export controls and so on. You have the Federal Trade Commission and the DOJ, which deals not only with competition policy, but over consumer harm issues related to AI and was extraordinarily active. And then you have all of the technocratic alphabet soup regulatory agencies, from the FDA to the FAA to the FCC to, EEOC, and I could go on down the list. All of them now very, very actively involved in AI policy, but without necessarily any clear direction. And so that's, I think, the key role that David Sacks will probably play in bringing some structure to that. While I'm not personally a fan of czars and czarism, I think it's probably good that he'll be there to see, sort of sit above it all and hopefully bring some direction to it. Building on what Satya said about what we can, learn from that original OMB guidance, I think what Sacks could do is just say, like, look, I'll work with Russell Vaught, who's back at the OMB, to basically say, once again, remind the agencies, you need to, quote, consider ways to reduce barriers to the development of the adoption of AI. or things that needlessly hamper AI innovation and growth. That's got to be priority number one if we're going to beat China and we're going to have a bold pro-innovation vision. And then specifically, it was what amazed me about the old OMB guidance is it specifically basically said to reject the European model. It said agencies, quote, must avoid a precautionary approach that holds AI systems to an impossibly high standard that society cannot enjoy their benefits. That is so, so crucial. I wrote a whole book called Permissionless Innovation, where I talk about the conflict divisions between the precautionary principle and permissionless innovation. And it said, look, Europe lost because they took that precautionary model to the extreme. And here in America, we took a more flexible, agile, iterative approach, which is what I think the new Trump vision will be for AI policy, very much focused on sort of like how we use more decentralized mechanisms, responsive approaches, so-called soft law governance, as opposed to the more top-down vision that the Biden White House was attempting to achieve, which, you know, got very aggressive. I mean, let's not forget, and I'll end it here, like, you know, President Biden issued the biggest executive order in American history about artificial intelligence, not just about anything, but about AI. You know, that's incredible. And, you know, now I think we're going to see that obviously repealed. And then we're going to see a pullback and a more decentralized approach with a lighter touch approach to AI policy that we should have kept from the Trump administration last time onward. But Mr. Biden decided to go in a different direction. So,
Adam, so you support you're against a top down approach as long as it's enforced by the strong hand of a czar.
Again, against czarism. I'm against czarism. But actually, no, I obviously that's an open question. What kind of power does Mr. Sachs even have here? I don't think he really has any. And, you know, we could get into sort of constitutional jurisprudence and like conservative principles having to do with like, do we feel that like extra legal positions like this should even be allowed? Personally, I'm against. But, you know, we've got it. We'll make the best of it. And again, I hope it's more of a coordinating role and an equalizing one that gets people on the same pro-innovation page. That would be a big win for the United States if the White House can do that. But personally, I just think they should have appointed him the head of OSDP and been done with it.
I think the applause for Adam for setting up all the law professors listening are thinking, okay, and I've got my next law review article, czarisms and the Constitution. Let's go. Neil, we've talked a lot about the continuity between the Trump administration, the Biden administration. But for me, the key difference, as echoed by Adam and Satya, is what I like to call the I word, right? Innovation being the North Star of the Trump administration. You've written extensively about how we may be able to remove some barriers to innovation from day one of the Trump administration. What are some of those low-hanging fruit efforts that might really unleash AI across the U.S.?
Well, I think to start, you know, the president has a powerful bully pulpit, right? And if you look at the executive order, the Biden executive order, it is pessimistic in the most part. It is the longest substantive executive order in U.S. history, and most of it is worried about risks, and it's worried about what might happen. And it directs a bunch of agencies to get involved and try to figure out like what kind of threats this presents. That's I think the wrong message from the executive branch. A better message would be one that is more enthusiastic about the technology, that is optimistic about what is possible here, that looks at the U.S. leadership here and says, let's maintain that. And I think the Trump administration is going to take that bully pulpit and they're going to send that message. Speaking of continuity, it is kind of interesting that the national security memorandum that the Biden administration put out does actually have a little bit more of that flavor. It has a flavor of, hey, this is a powerful technology and we should really be on top of it. And so maybe the Biden administration was sort of getting that message, certainly in the national security context. But I think we'll see that continue. So that's the first thing, bully pulpit saying, hey, we're America. This can be a very, you know, sort of MAGA message. We're America. We're the best in the world. We're building the best technology and God damn it, we're going to use it to make our lives amazing. So I think that will happen. You know, there's lots of ways.
That might be too long of a catchphrase for a hat, though, Neil. I'm not sure that's going to fit very well.
I'm not in branding. I don't know if you can tell. That's the high level messaging. There's lots of things in particular that the federal government can do, even without Congress jumping in the first instance, to just streamline the ability of government to use these technologies. The government has a lot of data. It has a lot of interesting data that when it tries to pursue its proper role in our federalist system. And it should be using the right IT tools to do that. And AI provides a lot of potential here for the government getting better at the jobs that it's supposed to be doing. And so, but there's a lot of barriers in the way. Some of those are procedural, some of those are habitual, some of those are procurement related. There really are a lot of challenges there. And the executive branch, I think, should try to take on a coordinated effort to figure out, hey, how can we use these technologies for the job that we're supposed to be doing for the American people? On the more maybe controversial side, and actually I think there's a lot of interesting law review articles to be written about this. We have a huge growing patchwork of state level AI policies. 700 plus active pieces of legislation last year. I expect it'll be quite a bit higher than that this year. Some of these have passed, and certainly more of them will pass. This is creating an innovation challenge, I think, for companies. This is a technology that really is a general purpose technology. To the extent that it needs regulation, it often flows across borders. At the most abstract level, at the model level, it's not clear exactly what the state nexus is here for regulation. And so there might be a role for preemptive legislation here. Now that's not just the executive branch role. Obviously Congress would have to get involved here, but that is certainly something that the Trump administration could call for. And I think it would probably make a lot of sense at the model level, when we're talking about just the models rather than the application level. I think it probably makes a lot of sense for the federal government to step in and say like, hey, we're not going to let 50 state patchwork of regulating abstract models and this technology. And so that's probably another one. A third one I'll throw out, which maybe would be surprising from the Trump administration, but I don't think unprecedented, would be improving our skilled immigration process. There is a big talent challenge here. The best AI people in the world want to work in the US. And I think the Trump administration should make that possible. Especially those who are educated here, and we don't want to export that. You could think of that as an export control. If it would help get the Trump administration on board, let's keep those people here building great products.
I don't know. It sounds like you may be good with branding, Neil. I mean, export controls for immigration purposes, creative. Satya, with that in mind, we saw looking to the Senate of the current administration, we had Senator Schumer lead his AI Insight forums, spent months and months talking to anyone and everyone who wanted to talk about AI. And then we got kind of the equivalent of a thesis from a Harvard Kennedy School student, just a memo on AI, basically, at the end of this incredible process. I can say that because I went there. That was the equivalent work product. What can we expect from having someone like Senator Cruz head up the Senate Commerce Committee? What might that mean about AI policy if we're looking to the Hill during the next administration?
Well, and yeah, so I mean, obviously the topic we're talking about is the Trump administration, which could be like a discrete entity in the branch of government, but also often we refer to a specific administration as actually like a synecdoche for an era in time. So I guess if we're taking that broader lens, I don't want to speak too specifically about what Senator Cruz, now incoming Chairman Cruz, is going to be doing based on, you know, what I know in our interactions. But I would note that, for instance, he publicly in the Commerce Committee markups, where they've considered a number of pieces of legislation, bipartisan pieces, some of which ended up seeing through the committee, but he stated on the record his opposition. He's skeptical of the work that NIST has undertaken through its AI Safety Institute. I think there's some concerns that one, as he put it, and this is not my view, I actually disagree with this, but that it is a pretense for regulatory capture. It's a pretext for further regulatory capture at some point, even though I would note that this is not a regulatory agency. And two, that their specific views are informed by a kind of left-wing ideology that he's obviously very opposed to. So at the same time, he has a bill that actually just after being stalled for a number of months, that just UC'd through the Senate, UC'd unanimous consent that passed the Senate without finding any objection, that would address platform responsibilities for non-consensual AI-produced deepfake porn, child pornography, things like that. I mean, I don't think anyone really disagrees that this is a problem, but there have been disagreements about what is the correct solution. There are obviously platform technologies and other technology companies that feel that they might be unfairly targeted through no fault of their own, that they might be taking liability that they shouldn't be responsible for. This is a bill that he has pushed actively, that he is the lead sponsor, and has pushed through the Senate after it was dormant for a number of months, which shows that he's engaged. So he does see, as far as I can tell, just his revealed preference, certain particular risks, certain problems. He's been critical of, quote, big tech, although I'm not sure where that line is drawn between little and big tech, because I'm just like, some little tech companies are actually quite huge and worth billions and billions of dollars. So I think he's going to, at the same time, this is the point I was going to wrap up. I think a lot of folks, not just Cruz, but a lot of Republicans, House Republican leadership, the Senate, they are going to be looking to the Trump administration, whether that's pre-inauguration, the transition, or once he's actually inaugurated, to give them direction and say, these are the things that we want. These are the kinds of policies that we want to support. Please go forward. We're going to work with you. We're going to push these things. Those are probably going to include things like on export controls, as Neil referenced, maybe expanded export control authority. Funding, it could involve a version of what NIST is doing under a rebranded name with a tighter focus and removing some of the, quote, as Cruz would say, woke elements of their mission. But a lot of them are kind of in a frozen state. I think they're going to look to the Trump administration to give them the thumbs up or thumbs down. Gladiator 2 style.
Well, not only have we seen AI action in the Senate, but we're also maybe as early as today, later today, sometime this week, we're expecting a report from the House's AI task force led by Representative Obernolte. Adam, can you give us a sense of what we may see from this report? There are rumors that it's going to be, you know, a Harry Potter length report that you're just going to have to tear through to try to synthesize. But what are the sort of tea leaves you're picking up with respect to this report?
Yeah, really briefly, the House AI Task Force was formed earlier this year in an effort to sort of counter the Schumer Task Force on AI that was underway over there in the Senate, but also to sort of come to some sort of consensus vision on, like, could we get bipartisan AI policy done in the House at all? And so it was chaired by Representative Jay Obernolte, who's the only member of Congress with a degree in AI. And he's actually one of the most thoughtful technology policy leaders I've seen in 33 years in this business. He's an amazing man. And he chaired that very ably with Representative Ted Lieu, a Democrat. They're both from California. They brought together a lot of different distinct voices to testify privately behind closed doors. I was honored to be there to talk on one of those panels. And they made a really good faith effort to try to take a step back and look at this in a more dispassionate way and think about what sound AI policy looks like. That being said, unsurprisingly, I don't think there's a lot of consensus there. I think there's a lot of contentiousness over a lot of key issues, including the number one issue that Mr. Obernolte himself put on the table, which was something Neil mentioned, which was federal preemption of the states. Apparently, the report is going to be about 200 to 250 pages long, sort of everything in the kitchen sink. But I think it'll be reading more like a GAO kind of report or a CRS report that sort of gives a broad overview of, like, all the literature and all of the different perspectives. And I think there's going to be moderated language on some of the different issues, such as preemption. There's apparently an entire chapter on preemption, but chapters on many, many other things, including AI risk and so on. That could literally drop any day. It's kind of surprising that report hasn't already dropped. But it's probably just going to lay the groundwork or put a framework for how we do policy in the next Congress, which Representative Obernolte and others, including Senator Cruz and the new House ENC Energy and Commerce Chair, Representative Guthrie, have basically taken a more, what I'll call, incremental approach, sort of a little bit more bottom up. There's certainly going to be some efforts at legislation, but I think you're going to have a more targeted approach. I mean, we've come a long way in this session of Congress over the last 2 years. Remember 2 years ago, we were talking about global bans on AI, freezing AI in place, pausing it, you know, licensing schemes, massive new federal bureaucracies. We've moved. we've moved in a positive direction, I think, and we're having a more rational conversation now. That being said, there's still a lot of contentious issues out there. Satya and Neil mentioned two of the five key tensions, I think, that we're going to see going forward, even in a unified Republican Congress and White House. Satya already mentioned the AI risk question and, like, do we need an AI safety institute created within NIST, which was basically something Biden did? Are the Republicans going to rubber stamp that and move on? I think that's an open question. There's tensions between various members on that. Number two, you know, we didn't mention, but I'll just mention there's industrial policy questions surrounding AI and, like, do we need a CHIPS too? A lot of Republicans would like to see more efforts to counter China with more investments being made. Others are more budget conscious and say, oh, hell no, you know, CHIPS one didn't work that well and we wasted a lot of money on Intel and let's not do that again. So that's another source of tension. The other is the preemption one that Neil mentioned that I just discussed. I think there's going to be some Republicans who say, well, yeah, we need a national framework, but you know what? We believe in states' rights too, and we're former governors and state lawmakers. And if nothing else, it's just going to be hard for them to move as fast as the states are moving. And then I'll just mention two other quick things briefly and then and kick it back to you, Kevin, that I think are going to be real sources of tension or rather uncertainties within the new White House in particular, but also in Congress. Number one, is open source AI a friend or a foe? Are we going to embrace open source as, like, a new great platform and set of opportunities for America to build on with, you know, not just companies like what Meta is doing with Llama, but many, many other smaller providers? Or are we going to take a more hawkish, traditional conservative perspective, which said, like, oh my gosh, open source is a threat to national security. We got to do something about it. When I was at Heritage Foundation for 10 years in the 90s, I used to go around as a big open source supporter, but a lot of my colleagues would say, what are you, some sort of communist or something? You know, it's like they treat it as, like, a danger or something that, like, only hippies supported. But now a lot of conservatives embrace open source as an alternative to big tech.
So that's including your old friends at Heritage, Adam.
That's true.
Very, very cheery about open source.
Yeah. And so that's going to be an interesting tension. Not clear how that's worked out at the highest levels of the White House with the national security community and other people. And then there's one final thing. Conservatives have been very concerned about big tech, as we've all said here, and so-called woke AI or woke, you know, speech. And there's been a movement to, like, get rid of Section 230 and to push back against large technology companies. But at the same time, conservatives have made a big stink about, like, the weaponization of federal government, about, like, overreach on speech. And so there's a palpable tension at the highest levels of the Republican Party today about where we go on algorithmic speech. You know, is code speech or algorithm speech? What kind of control should government have over them and the platforms that circulate them? That is, I think, the most important tension that will play out next session, because every lawmaker I talk to, I go in and they say, what are we going to do to counter China on AI? And in the next breath, they say, what are we going to do to stop big tech? And at some point, those things conflict pretty violently if your solution to stopping big tech ends up undermining your efforts to counter China, which they very well could.
Well, Adam, I trust that no one's still confusing you with a communist anymore. But Neil, I think you were chipping in there.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, this is... That last particular point on speech and AI platforms is really, really particularly relevant given David Sachs's new role. That is an issue that he has raised over and over. And so I think it's one that he is likely to continue. It also is one that goes right back to the very beginning of, you know, the very first hearings post ChatGPT, which sort of brought a social media frame. I think Congress has actually gotten a lot more sophisticated since that time. They sort of realized this is not the same as social media. There's some really big, like, business model differences. There's some really big sort of economic incentive differences. And there's also just, you know, because there aren't the same sort of feedback loops that there are on social media, we just have an explosion of lots of different models. And so I think people are still figuring out how that's going to play out, but it certainly will continue to be a theme in the Trump administration about these are big, powerful tools. They affect how we choose what we say and what does that mean for speech and communication in the U.S.
Well, and Neil, to broaden our perspective yet even a little bit further to address the FTC, with which you're very familiar, and antitrust enforcement, this is kind of another area that We just don't know, does big tech in this instance include some of these major AI companies? We've seen under Chair Khan, there have been concerns about anti-competitive actions by AI labs. Most recently, we've seen that Gail Slater is going to head up the antitrust division under the DOJ, former Vance staffer, currently being touted as someone who shares that anti-big tech agenda. But meanwhile, at the FTC, we're still playing musical chairs. Pun intended, we don't know who the chair is going to be. What are the tea leaves there? What's adding up for our antitrust picture under the Trump administration?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, the first reaction of the Biden FTC to the release of ChatGPT was a series of blog posts. I think the very first one was on competition issues, and it was like the state of having a hammer, so you think everything's a nail. Like they looked at this amazing explosion of competition in a space that really like was not didn't like these large language models that were consumer facing. Like that was not a market, right? Exploded, and all of a sudden, like their first reaction was like, "What are the competitive problems that might be here?" And that continued with you know the Biden administration chatting with European colleagues and having a consensus document that shares a bunch of those concerns. I think those concerns are crazy, frankly. This is an explosive space of innovation, and there are big companies involved, but there's thousands and thousands of little companies, and there's tons of open source. I mean, Hugging Face, which is a repository for open source models, I think has 400,000 different models. Now, they're not all the premier models, but a lot of them are quite useful for very specific tasks. And so the amount of competition there, I think, is huge. So when we think about the intersection of AI, I noticed there's a quote or there's a comment in the Q&A suggesting maybe we shouldn't talk about AI policy. And I have some sympathy to that. I think often we should, instead of saying AI, we should probably just say advanced computation. So if we think about the future of competition in the advanced computation space, there are a lot of big players. I think we'll continue to see some action, but I would warn, and I think that one of the ways that we could most hamper our ability to compete with China would be to imitate China here. And to that very point, China just opened an investigation into NVIDIA, a competition investigation, an antitrust investigation into NVIDIA, because they're angry about export controls from the US and some other tariff policy. And so that shows the political nature of these investigations, the way they can be misused. And I think the U.S. would be doing a real disservice to itself if we wield antitrust in investigations the same way that the Biden administration did. And I somewhat anticipate that we will move in a different direction under Trump. There's, in some ways, it'd be hard to get worse than the antitrust efforts of the Biden administration, but I'm not encouraging the Trump administration to try, and I don't think they will. I think they're going to focus really on what are the types of antitrust cases that we can bring that will make Americans' lives better. Most Americans, use Google and think it's a great product. Now, the Trump administration did bring that search case. It was a pretty straightforward, normal type of antitrust case, even if maybe some of the evidence in there is weaker than the judge gave it credit for. But it wasn't the type of radical revision of antitrust policy that means antitrust is a way to get political objectives that are outside of, making consumers better off in place. And so I think we'll see that dial back. And in the AI space, I think it's a robust industry. We should just try really hard to facilitate that. And one way to do that is not with overreaching antitrust enforcement.
And speaking of potential hindrances to that innovation, we've talked briefly about this patchwork of AI policy that's developing throughout the states. Adam, you have your pulse on this maybe better than anyone I know. What are we seeing emerge at the states in terms of pro-innovation or perhaps a focus more on ethics issues, content issues? What's the makeup? Is it a little bit of everything and anything, or are states kind of coalescing around a specific agenda?
Yeah, great question. And Neil already touched upon it, talking about the over 700 plus bills, depending on whose count you believe, it's even higher. And they're kind of all over the place, but we can at least break down a couple of key buckets where we are trying to see states trying to regulate AI qua AI, regulate general purpose computing in a general way. And some of that is really concerning to me. I mean, obviously, we had a huge, huge fight in California this year over SB 1047, which was their frontier AI model regulation thing. That was essentially trying to regulate, you know, a high powered computation frontier AI at the core. And that was it. That was a fight like I haven't seen since going back to the crypto wars, the late 1990s, in terms of the strange bedfellows that united on both sides of that issue. Now, at the end of the day, even though the California legislature passed that, you know, Governor Newsom vetoed that bill. And there haven't been a lot of cookie cutter bills like that, but I think there's going to be a few more coming, and California could always reintroduce that. But I think a lot of that debate probably does shift more to the federal level. And this question we've already teed up about, like, what happens with the AI Safety Institute and NIST standards and so on and so forth. But the bigger bucket is really what I'll call the sort of the AI ethics or AI non-discrimination bucket. And we've already seen a major piece of legislation pass in Colorado that Governor Polis signed in, I believe, May. And we've seen an effort made through a working group that's headed up by the Future of Privacy Forum that I testified in front of just yesterday morning, of 200 state lawmakers trying to coalesce around a sort of consensus vision for what I'll just basically call like mini EU AI acts for the United States. And these bills would try to find a way to so-called, quote unquote, get out ahead of concerns about bias and discrimination of many sorts, and have a whole bunch of provisions that require preemptive sort of like reviews and so-called algorithmic impact assessments or even AI audits, a new bureaucracy or new powers for attorneys general. There are bills like this now that obviously, again, have passed in Colorado, got close to passing in Connecticut, now introduced in Texas and sponsored by a Republican, no less, moving in several other states. Virginia last week moved their bill like this. New York City's got one like this, and California has a bill like this as well. I think if we were having this conversation at this time next year, we would see maybe a half dozen to a dozen of those bills moving very fast, close to the finish line, maybe a few getting over it, and Congress still sitting around wondering, like, what are we going to do? How are we going to preempt? Because when they claim it's about consumer harm and so-called discrimination, then they're going to say, well, that's a state prerogative and you don't have any right to preempt. So there's a real danger here that, unlike the internet, where we did not have that patchwork, we did not have 50, you know, internet bureaus in every state. In fact, Congress preempted not only a whole heck of a lot of regulation in the mid-90s. Back in 1998, we regulated and preempted at the federal level against taxation. We had the Internet Tax Freedom Act. Like, things like this are almost unthinkable in the current Congress. There's nobody in any of the 114 bills pending in Congress right now in AI. Nothing said about preemption. Now, maybe that'll change in the Trump administration and the new Congress. I hope it does. But if not, this train's rolling fast down the tracks in the states. It is what I've called the mother of all technocratic patchworks. I've never seen anything like this in my life, 33 years of covering these things. Nothing comes close to this. And the danger is that we're going to get all these different mounting compliance costs with these different regimes. And even if there's some consensus around the Colorado bill, at the margins, it's different. Texas is saying we're going to do it slightly differently. Colorado or Connecticut says a different way, different agencies, different requirements, different onus of liability. Is it on the deployer, on the distributor, on the, you know, the developer? It varies by definitions. This is a confusing, crazy, you know, patchwork of policies that will just decimate algorithmic innovation and competition in the United States. And I really do hope Congress takes it up.
And we also briefly discussed China and open source as perhaps another big issue that's going to take up a lot of attention for the Trump administration. I'll open it up to any and all of you to give us a sense of just how much of a priority do we think this so-called AI arms race with China is going to be? Do we think that's going to only escalate as we see geopolitical tension and chaos seemingly continue to exacerbate across the world? Or are we going to see some of these more cultural issues win out and dominate the narrative? Happy to get responses from all three of you.
I mean, I think I think it's going to be foremost, at least as a framing and a guide star. Just looking at some of the folks that have been tapped to advise this incoming administration, and some of the folks that I know that have been sort of transition circles, this framing of what can we do to hit the accelerator for the US and tap the brakes for China and other adversaries is almost like a cultural meme in some of these circles that's been fully metabolized into the body of Trump. At the same time, president-elect Trump has always negotiated, right? And he's shown both, you know, first term or over the last 4 years in the campaign that there's no guiding point of a policy that is an end in and of itself. It's all instrumental to get to whatever the larger goal is for the administration. So there could be pushes and pulls with respect to China and other allied semi-quasi adversaries of us to make sure that they sort of, in broad stark terms, choose us over them, that we are continuing to lead in that. I think there's no way around that. Those security risks are, there's an acknowledgement that the risks of ascendant China and just national security risks in particular are going to be born somewhere. And so you might as well account for them up front in these policies, because we can avoid things like expensive ex post rip and replace efforts, which is still going on, contractor certification. So that's the like one prediction I'm pretty confident that is going to continue to be at North Star. I also I know there's a reference to like AI policy isn't a thing, because it's not defined. Like, yeah, okay, fine. Yeah. Like, you go deep enough down, the meta structure of a word, you can find some of its definition. It doesn't matter. That's the framing that policymakers use. So whether they can like actually define AI, like that is actually the framing they're going to use. So it may be incorrect, but like, being precious about it, like comic book guy on The Simpsons. Well, actually, it's just not useful, because this is the frame that administration and policymakers are going to use is AI policy, even if strictly speaking, it's not correct.
Satya, I think you've just introduced your branding skills, so we've got that going for you. Does anyone else want to hit on the China open source? We've got some great questions. Don't worry, I'm actively paying attention to them, and we will get to many of them. But Neil, Adam, any comments on open source in China?
I'll just add one quick one, which is that I think the China framing does dominate the social framing. There is a way in which you can talk about both of them to say like, hey, China, we don't want China's CCP infused AI taking over the world. And the big challenge there, I think you're going to see this disrupt not just relationships with China, but I think it's going to make some tensions with Europe grow. Europe has basically been passing laws that more or less only apply to American big tech companies. And I should say those thresholds are often just above where the Chinese tech companies are. And so the Chinese companies are still delivering services to Europe. And the US companies are pulling back or are heavily restricted. And so I think the Trump administration may look at that and say like, hey, what is going on in Europe? This is not great for the US. Frankly, it's also not that great for Europe. What's going on there? The one other thing I'd say is that, and I should have mentioned this before, I think the rhetoric vis-a-vis China will explode past like what we might strictly call, you know, AI policy, to use that branding, although I am somewhat more skeptical of it. The big challenge here of AI policy as a branding is that artificial intelligence is really just cutting edge computer science. Every time it becomes, you know, integrated into our phones, we don't call it AI anymore. And so it really is a big bucket that allows people to regulate all of computation. And I don't think that's the road we want to go down. So while rhetorically it's useful, I think when you actually put pen to paper for regulation, it gets really, really dangerous and really overbroad. So I think legislatures will learn that lesson, but they haven't quite yet. And I was going to say something else, but I'll save it for the questions.
One final point to add on to this, I agree with everything that Satya and Neil had to say, but to link it to one of the excellent questions here in our Q&A from Ryan Hageman. which is that the China issue is important because it affects international relations with our partners, or sort of the broad coalition of the willing, if you will, that could be out there working together on AI policy to counter China and autocratic authoritarian governments. And we have some good partners to work with on this. In his question, Ryan mentioned Singapore and Japan, but there are others who don't take either the China approach or the European approach on the extremes, but have a more moderate, middle of the road, pragmatic, sort of bottom up approach to AI governance. And I think this is going to be crucial because during the Biden years, we got bogged down with a lot of the AI existential risk stuff being part of the international dialogue. And through international fora, questions like, how do we have international governance of AI to address AI risk? I think it's going to flip. And under the Trump administration, that'll still be part of the discussion, but now it'll be like AI security and international relations and geopolitical power. And it's going to be a very different kind of conversation. It'll sound more like what some people call AI Cold War talk. Hey, that's inevitable. This is reality. Technology, especially if technology is powerful, is part of geopolitical realities. And I think the Trump administration is going to change the tone of the dialogue and work with a coalition in the middle of the willing to come together and push back against both China and Europe. That's my hope.
We've had a couple great questions flag the essential nature of energy production for ongoing innovation in AI. And we've seen some hints from the Department of Energy under the Biden administration really trying to think about how we can increase energy production. Do we anticipate that the Trump administration is just going to push pedal to the metal on all those efforts? What can we anticipate from an energy policy here? Satya, looks like you're ready to go on this one.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, I think, a very clear a place where the Trump too is going to be the leaning on. This has been probably where the rhetoric from President-elect Trump himself, as well as a number of other of his senior advisors and folks he's pulled in, has been the most explicit, at least in terms of what the goal is. It is all energy all the time. And of course, this isn't an AI problem, or maybe AI isn't a real thing. It's not a computation constraint problem. It's an economic problem. Like, there's no version of the future, the near future, that doesn't require more energy. Like, this administration clearly acknowledges that, as well as wanting to reward those industries. So, you know, at the end of the Trump one, there were, in addition to specific rules from the Department of Interior and EPA and Department of Energy that tried to lower the barrier to energy capacity, as well as research and infrastructure build out, there was a pretty major reform of NEPA, which has become sort of the boogeyman of a lot of this. NEPA does, as people know, introduce a lot of veto points. But again, that's not an AI or computation or advanced computing problem. That's a much broader problem because it applies to a large category where of infrastructure needs, not just energy, but where energy, of course, is an upstream input to almost everything. So I think you're going to lean on there. There was a bipartisan bill in the Senate, Manchin Barrasso at Senate Energy and Natural Resources passed, I think, unanimously. I think the political will for that bill died because this unified Republican government sees an opportunity starting next year to say go even bigger and not to have to concede to what they view as maybe concessions they had to make this a bipartisan bill. Of course, the reconciliation, if incoming Majority Leader Thune gets his way, the first reconciliation bill will have energy as one of its three core policy components. So this is something where you will see the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress in lockstep, especially if they're able to employ a mechanism that doesn't require a veto-proof majority, or I'm sorry, filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. And you will see there may be language in there about directing the Council on Economic Quality or Department of Energy or EPA or Interior to build out some of the implementation to lower the barriers to infrastructure build out, especially with respect to energy.
Yep, I agree with all that. And let's just remember that in the Republican GOP platform, there was a promise to, quote, boost, quote, reliable and abundant low-cost energy options. And as Satya pointed out, you have a lot of alignment on the Hill on this. Incoming chair of House ENC, Guthrie, who's just announced yesterday, he and Representative Obernolte sent a letter just, I think, a month or two ago to the Department of Energy about these issues. Senator Cruz is in line with this. This should be a layup for the Republicans in the White House, if you want to sort of first order a business, it's the unification of two concurrent technological revolutions in energy and AI. And there's a symbiotic relationship between them now. They're linked at the hip. So reform is going to have to happen there.
One of the interesting questions in the queue had to do with government use of AI for surveillance. There have been articles mentioning, for example, the potential use of AI for enforcement of laws, especially with respect to immigration laws. Do any of you have any comments on whether we may see the Trump administration lean into the use of AI for law enforcement, or whether a sort of Big Brother narrative is going to win out and we'll see a more of a civil liberties perspective dominate?
Well, just to start, I will say that on the sort of left of center, or maybe more broadly civil libertarian discussion, a lot of the focus has really been on commercial uses, and sort of government uses have been sidelined. And I don't know that that will change that much under a Trump administration, but I do think we might see an energized, center left or left group that does take on more of that point, as it's not the Biden administration that might be deploying these tools. So that may come back. On top of that, when it comes to, say, border enforcement, I mean, there are a lot of folks who have been pitching technological solutions to that for a long time. I think we'll probably see those pitches landing a little bit more with the Trump administration. And so I wouldn't be that surprised if some of this technology starts to get deployed. I just hope we spend the time and the energy to make sure that government is protecting our constitutional rights in the meantime.
I mean, we've seen a fair amount of growth in the, say, kind of like commercialization for-profit AI sector. And these are companies that self-identify as AI. And now I got that idea in my head that AI is a mixed term. But like a lot of the growth in that industry has been for government uses and government use cases, you know, especially defense applications, right? I think, again, looking at the sort of circle of folks that went all in for candidate Trump in the VC circles. I mean, these are the Silicon Valley VC investment circles. These are people who have large investments, have also gone all in on defense applications, defense uses. You know, Elon Musk talks about replacing all fighter pilots with drones or something kind of thereabout. I think that one thing we didn't talk about that you will probably see in a future Trump administration is reforms, some of which will require congressional approval, but changes to acquisition and procurement more broad, not just defense, but especially in the defense sector, make it easier for startups, for innovative kind of edge case technology developers to get in front of the government buyers, to not have to hold hands necessarily with, major incumbent contractors, and to introduce and make it easier for government agencies to engage like pilot projects, you know, before full deployment, look at it. You know, look, even in 2020, it was sort of this nascent technology, or at least to the degree it was in practical use cases, we were encouraging agencies to look for creative use cases. We had a whole rule that was issued and nobody challenged that used natural language processing to look for opportunities to clean up the regulatory code itself, right? And HHS did that. That was a pilot project. If it was successful and there was a second term, that would have been deployed across the entire government. But your question is more kind of like balancing those things. I don't know exactly how they feel. Obviously, border security is another stated explicit priority for this Trump administration. It's a thing that Trump campaigned on over and over again, and Republicans more broadly. So I don't know how they'll play. I think that overall on net, the ease of selling or at least presenting interesting, innovative use cases, the government's going to get easier over the next 4 years. And there's going to be an active encouragement for agencies to look for deployment, not necessarily just for like security uses, other, you know, making processes more efficient and customer service uses, thing, you know, more mundane kind of government services like that.
And as we bring this great panel to a close, or start to bring it to a close, before we get to closing remarks, I do want to address And I apologize for the bad jokes. I'm a professor. I have to make civil procedure and admin law exciting. So I have to lean on bad dad jokes. We have to address the Elon in the room, right? Adam, we know that Elon has actually supported some AI safety legislation, such as SB 1047 in California. We know it within his own inner circle, there are some folks who are very AI safety conscious, focusing on these existential risks. We also know that Elon has been very much in the shadow and in the room, the same room as President Trump, President-elect Trump. So, Adam, have we reached peak AI safety? Are we going to see this narrative crest and we're going to really zero in on innovation? Or might we see a rekindling and a resurgence of that narrative come 2025?
Yeah, great closing question. I don't think we've reached peak AI safety, but I think we've reached peak AI existential risk. I think that debate and rhetoric around it has been a little bit exhausted because people just took it to the extreme. There were these constant Chicken Little, you know, scenarios bandied about, you know, the end times cometh. And the reality is, you know, the world works differently and it wasn't as extreme as they are making it out to be. And their calls for solutions were so completely out of control between pausing AI and, you know, crazy Manhattan projects for AI that would like have the government, you know, essentially quasi-nationalize it all in the name of safety. That debate's done. I don't think that's a debate anymore. But as Satya and Neil alluded to in our earlier part of our discussion, you know, we're still going to have a conversation about, you know, should we have an AI safety institute? Should we have NIST AI risk management frameworks that are broadly applicable to new potential vulnerabilities or dangers? And then we haven't even talked about the various agencies that deal with AI safety writ large, but in a very targeted way in certain sectors every single day. I mean, the FDA and AI and ML medical devices, they're on top of this every day. They've got all sorts of stuff happening. The FAA and autonomous flying systems, drones, they're on top of that. And NHTSA and driverless cars, speaking beyond Musk, they've fined them. They've recalled Teslas from the market. AI governance happens on the ground all the time. AI safety happens in real time all the time. But this grandiose debate that unfortunately Musk and others, you know, fuel that ridiculous narrative of like existential risk, sky is falling, extreme solutions necessary. I think we've turned the page. I really have, especially after the California veto. They sort of put all their eggs in that basket and like went for broke. And we're gonna have a different kind of, I think, more sensible, pragmatic discussion about AI safety going forward.
Thanks, Adam. Now we know what to expect. We've had some great estimates and predictions about what we may see in 2025. But before we let you all get on to pondering the future of AI yourselves, Neil, Satya, and then Adam, any closing final remarks?
I think the AI speech debate is going to be huge this year, and thinking about what that looks like in a principled way from a conservative and libertarian point of view, I think is really important. The types of pressure and the types of internal and cultural pressure that companies face to create a good product, but also maybe to embody certain ideas. And what is the role of the government in that process is something that has been working its way through the social media system, but it looks really different in the artificial intelligence space. And so I just hope people take a step back, they pause for a little bit, and they think like, what from first principles, let's work out like what it means to have a really good speech environment given the rise of this new technology.
Thanks, Neil. Satya?
I think there's a couple, like if I'm going to make a prediction about sort of subtopics that I think will continue to grow in interest among policymakers, especially in Congress. I made a reference to it before, but I think this issue of deepfakes, however defined, and that could be political deepfakes, it could be totally sort of mostly innocuous and humorous, but I think especially on this acute issue of pornographic, non-consensual imagery, how do we draw the line? What are people entitled to? Is this a violation of people's privacy and their, and just even just cultural norms, expectations, right? Like what is the norm here? I think there was a reference in the chat about IP, which we kind of didn't get, but that's going to be a growing issue. Obviously, some of the Hollywood unions have acutely taken this on in their negotiations with studios. There is a concerted group in Congress that's very concerned about IP issues, especially from the creative community, but also businesses as well, like larger businesses. I don't think that's going away. And I think, I don't know as a policy topic, but there's going to be a growing interest in what is the frontier edge capabilities? How do we think of these? Is it going in a way that follows other technologies? I think AI, however defined, has some unique things. I know Adam he's fond of pointing out hysteria around, you know, technologies and like old archive newspaper reports and showing like how ridiculous it is. The introduction of television is going to ruin America, so on. But I think there are some unique characteristics, and not for nothing, like as a former Mercatus Center person, as a hardcore Coastian, I mean, there are externalities. National security is an externality that's not easily internalized. And especially if we have a committed adversary, and there are capabilities that often emerge in a way that other technologies, those capabilities are built in by design, right? So I think there'll always be a discussion, around those kind of three things.
Thanks, Adam. The final word.
Yeah, I'll remind everyone that when President Trump last week nominated David Sacks to be this new White House AI czar, he said it was, quote, with the goal of making America the clear global leader in both areas, AI and cyber and crypto. And I think that's great. I think we finally have a chance to embrace a positive pro-innovation vision as a nation and get back on track. I think we've been sidelined with a lot of dismal dystopianism in this debate over the last 4 years. It's really been unfortunate. And I'm hopeful that changes. The only thing I'll say is a word of caution is that there are a lot of people, including Mr. Trump himself and other MAGA conservatives, who are on the warpath against so-called big tech and are, you know, they want blood. they want to take down large tech companies by any means necessary. You know, you got to be very, very cautious about that, because the largest technology companies are the ones that are investing the most in AI. You know, this summer it was revealed they invested $335 billion in AI R&D over the previous year, which was 3x more than China, including China's public sector investment. We have to keep in mind that these are part of our new arsenal of democracy, and that they're there to help us fight against China and the rest of the world. And again, achieve that goal that President Trump laid out of, quote, making America the clear global leader in AI.
Well, with that, thank you so much to all of our attendees. Huge thanks to our panelists. And Kayla, I'll kick it over to you after we say thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting.
Appreciate it. I'll echo those thanks. Really appreciate our panel joining us and sharing your valuable expertise and insight. It was a great discussion and really interesting to listen. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.